Well, thank you for coming. Tonight's the fourth in a series of five lectures, and for the benefit of those of you who weren't here for the previous ones, I'll just sort of briefly indicate the sort of approach that I've been taking to the Old Testament. The first was a lecture on the fall and the rejection of Eden, in which I was dealing with basically the myth of the Garden of Eden as the description of the nature of human consciousness and the nature being associated with language and sexuality and the relationship between the dialectic of opposites, male and female being one set of opposites, language and the nonverbal consciousness of the angels being another system of consciousness. And that I was basically showing how the Old Testament was a map of a description of the nature of consciousness and its problems and its contradictions. That then flowed into a second problem of the nature of human culture. How does one create a culture that can hold values in time against the disruptive forces of time that attempt to scatter it and disrupt and end all human values in their endurance through human time? So that there I was dealing with the Old Testament as a map of culture basically rejecting civilization. And that in terms of Abraham, that the cities of the Old Testament are seen to be under a curse, and that urban civilization itself is a system of human excellence that basically is an oversimplification of consciousness and therefore is an inherent contradiction, an inherent division, an intolerable strain, and basically doesn't work, so that what we see in Genesis is the rejection of civilization as the appropriate cultural vehicle. I move from that then into Exodus as a model of how one deals with the collision of values when civilization and tribal community meet. Abraham was affirming the values of the patriarchal, nomadic, moving, dynamic kind of life against the static, hierarchical, wealth-accumulating life of the cities of Ur. When we come to Egypt, it isn't so much a question of just going out unto the land that I will show you, as Abraham is spoken to by Yahweh, but trying to instigate a revolution, because Abraham was able to by himself to leave Ur and to go unto the land that God would show him. But when we're dealing with the internal proletariat of the Hebrews as slaves in Egypt, we're dealing with a whole civilizational structure. And the only way that Moses can address himself to that structure is through revolution, by making the bottom the top and the top the bottom. So I was dealing with the phenomenon of revolution as an address to the crisis of values in a particular historical context and circumstance. From there, I was getting into the pattern of the prophetic leader himself as an indication of a divided man, an individual in whom the opposite values of civilization and tribe clash, and so that in the context of the prophet's own temperament, he has to fight out violently the war of those colliding opposites of tribe and civilization. So I looked at Moses as the divided man, as both Egyptian and Hebrew, and referred to other examples of revolutionary prophetic personalities like Malcolm X or Padraic Pearse in Ireland, who are themselves children of both cultures, where the father may be from the overlords, but the mother is from the underlord culture. And that this is a phenomenon that one can see when one is dealing with leaders of what the anthropologists would call nativistic movements, those movements that reject civilization, reject the ways of the overlords, and affirm the tribal ways of the underdogs. Now, when we come to tonight, to 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 Kings, we're dealing with an interesting phenomenon of the evolution of a culture and its transformation, both technologically and ideologically. And we're dealing with a situation in which we're watching the internal strains build up within the Hebrews themselves, rather than watching, say, the Hebrews just simply being oppressed by the Egyptians. So what I want to focus on tonight is continuing that model of essentially dealing with the problem of culture. How do you hold values in time? And focusing on the difficulties the Hebrews have holding values in time as they are forced to move through various different levels of social organization, from tribe to a kind of amphictyony of tribal confederation to nation state to kingdom to sort of empire, and watching the incredible strains that this creates in their own relationship between their technological means of production and their ideological traditional heritage from their religion. When we're looking at 1 Samuel, we're basically dealing with the dialectic between barbarism and civilization. And this dialectic that we saw in, say, Abraham versus the third dynasty of Ur is almost an archetypal pattern going throughout human history from one end to the other and from one continent to another. If you're talking about, say, the Semitic Akkadians coming in and conquering the Sumerians and then in turn being conquered by their higher civilized culture, so that Sumerian culture begins to win in the mind as the Akkadian culture is winning in the body, you're dealing with a pattern that will be true whether you're talking about the Goths over the Romans, or you're talking about, as tonight, the Canaanites over the Hebrews, or you're talking about the Toltecs in Mexico over the conquered Teotihuacanos, or then again the Aztecs over the Toltecs that they conquer. It's a pattern in which one culture may come in and conquer, but the destroyed civilization has such a heritage that it begins to pull the conquered primitive culture in its direction, and they begin worshiping their gods and forming and following, if for no other reason than the kind of tremendous snob appeal and attraction that the older culture has. It creates the pattern of civilization, and so if you're Sargon of Akkad and you're trying to legitimize your conquest, inevitably you're going to be led in the direction of using Sumerian ideals to lend a kind of mystique and lend class to what is basically brute power. It's just in the same sense that Europe has a certain mystique that seems to be much more graceful. The British Empire seems to be more tasteful and distinguished than just the sort of raw commercialism of, say, the American Empire. And this has to do with just kind of older heritage. So this pattern is one that is really archetypal in the dialectic between barbarism and civilization. In 1 Samuel, see it very clearly in the Hebrews over the Canaanites. The Canaanites are much more civilized. They have metal, they have chariots, they have incredibly much more civilized and sophisticated urban architecture and plumbing. And that when you, when the architects, archaeologists like Albright come in to do archaeological research, they find very sophisticated, very developed, beautiful Canaanitic architecture. And then the Hebrew invasion coming in, and the level of construction and the plumbing and everything is really rank and inferior and primitive, and that these are the raggle-taggle wastrels pouring in out of the desert who have no culture, no civilization. They're really the kind of the dregs of what was the slaves of Egypt. So it's very clear that the Hebrews, from any civilized, sophisticated, urban, cultured point of view, are just beneath contempt. They are really the dregs of that culture. But the interesting thing about reading it from the point of view of the Old Testament is here we have the opposite point of view. Now we're really seeing the barbarian hordes as the good guys. We tend to, even though we may associate Gothic civilization with our own heritage, we tend to look upon the sacking of Rome as savage, and that the Goths are barbarians, and so the whole word barbarian has a negative association. But here, it's the opposite. The barbarians are God's chosen, they're anointed, they're the good guys, and so we are seeing the collision of tribe and civilization from the point of view of tribe, and from their point of view, the Canaanites are unspeakably decadent and depraved and involved with all kinds of orgiastic, sexual, ritualistic, religious forms that are repellent to them at the same time that they're tremendously attractive. And so this kind of love, hate, and ambivalence back and forth between the Hebrew religion and the Canaanitic one will be the story for centuries after the time of the invasion of Palestine. But the important thing to remember is that the Canaanites are much more advanced in the arts of civilization. So we are seeing again in miniature this dialectical problem that we've been seeing it almost pulse back and forth or turn and twist like a double helix, both with Abraham and Ur and then with Moses in Egypt. And now we're seeing it with the Canaanites and the Hebrews. And for them, there is, for these civilized Canaanites, a sense of ritual, of poetry, of song, of ceremony, of drama, and of incarnation, so that whether it's dealing with wine or the body or sexuality as a vehicle of religious experience in their orgiastic rites, there's a whole sense of culture that is just abhorrent, shocking, and tremendously insightful, and in the sense that's a pun, both meanings of insightful, to the Hebrews, and it creates this whole sense of ambivalence. Now, what you have in this collision as they invade the Promised Land and begin to try to take it over tribal area by tribal area, city-state by city-state, is one of the other paradoxes of the relationship of opposites, and that's the paradox of conflict, that in order to defeat your enemy, you must become exactly like your enemy. Now, the Hebrew, in moving into Palestine, they confront chariots and they confront armor. In the case of the Philistines, they have iron, and they won't allow any blacksmiths to practice with the Hebrews, so that the Hebrews, if they were to have a plow, would have to come to the Philistines themselves to sharpen their plows, and they would not be allowed to have any weaponry whatsoever. So they're confronted with not only the Canaanites, but also the Philistines, the sea people, with a civilization that's much more advanced technologically. They have merely infantrymen, they are peasant warriors, they are simply loosely bound in a confederation, they have only kind of tribal leadership, and suddenly when they move out into the plains, then the chariots of the Canaanites and the Philistines just move in and they don't have a chance at all. It's the same as if foot soldiers were to try to take on modern tanks. So they're confronted with a situation that they're overwhelmingly outnumbered, the technology is vastly superior to anything they have, and they have to find some way to protect their religion, their faith, their space against an alien and hostile enemy. But the paradox is that in order to protect their religion and their way of life, they must somehow let go of it and begin to accommodate as much as they can to the ways of the overlord. So they have to learn the ways of iron, which has always been a cursed form in tribal, a cursed technology in tribal cultures. In 1 Samuel, you are not to have an altar of hewn stone. You must not use metal to cut a stone. You must just pile up loose rocks and there make your burnt offering to the Lord. To hew a stone or to use metal is to commit a kind of sacrilegious act. So there's a suspicion of the metallurgist because he represents specialization, and that means civilization and all its discontents. Now, not only are they confronting a vastly technologically superior culture and military form, they're also confronting a far more sophisticated political structure. The Canaanites and the Philistines have their kind of urban bureaucracies, and they have kingship, although it's basically a king of each city-state. And they themselves just have a loose gathering of tribes that has no solidarity except the solidarity of the Mosaic Covenant, a solidarity of the sense that there is their one Lord. They try to come together in a tribal confederacy and create one central religious shrine in Shiloh, but of course even later that's lost as the Philistines utterly destroy Shiloh and scatter and capture the Ark of the Covenant. So what they have to deal with then is that in order to win over their enemies, they have to become like them. They must become them, and in a sense, you become what you hate, and so the paradox of conflict is that you turn into everything you are trying to escape. And so the central problem and paradox that 1 and 2 Samuel present us with is, how do you hold values in time through conflict against an enemy if in conflict with that enemy you must become exactly like him? And obviously the paradox is that you don't. You lose. Even in being defeated you lose, but in winning you also lose. And so what it studies in a sense is the phenomenology of defeat. So the people come to Samuel, who is their judge, and all that the Hebrews have known since the invasion of Palestine is a kind of loose succession of charismatic rulers, where one individual who is either skillful in arbitrating disputes or one powerful warlord who was able to win a battle becomes a judge. And the one judge succeeds another without any kind of dynastic succession and without any sense of the supremacy of one tribe over another. But as they finally hit the collision of the Philistines, then they decide that this will not work and they must have a king. And so they come to Samuel and they demand a king. And Samuel, who is the last of the judges, who will anoint, in a sense, the first of the kings, is himself a kind of fascinating character because he represents the whole aspect of the conservative, the tribal, the anti-civilized view, confronting the political problems of an overwhelming civilization that's grinding the tribes into extinction. Samuel told the people who were asking him for a king all that the Lord had said to him, quote, "This will be the sort of king who will govern you. He will take your sons and make them serve in his chariots and with his cavalry, and he will make them run before his chariot. Some he will appoint officers over units of 1,000 and units of 50. Others will plow his fields and reap his harvest. Others, again, will make weapons of war and equipment for mounted troops. He will take your daughters for perfumers, cooks, and confectioners, and will seize the best of your cornfields, vineyards, and olive yards, and give them to his lackeys. He will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage to give to his eunuchs and lackeys. Your slaves, both men and women, and the best of your cattle and your asses, he will seize and put them to his own use. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and yourselves will become his slaves. When that day comes, you will cry out against the king whom you have chosen, but it will be too late. The Lord will not answer you. So the description is the whole problem of civilization and its discontents, that it means taxation, alienation, the accumulation of wealth, hierarchy, and all that it contains. And Samuel is coming and speaking in favor of decentralization, of tribal autonomy, of the religion of the past, of the nomadic succession, that the god dwells only in tents and is not living in some particular permanent temple or Ark of the Covenant. So it's dealing basically with the collision of values of tribe and city. The problem, when the two confront one another, is what to do, how to create a unity when the tribes themselves are fighting and will not accept any particular unity. And if you're to create a king over them, if you pick one king from one tribe, then the other tribe will immediately go into civil war and tear the whole union apart, and then you will face the kind of divide and conquer success by which the Philistines can come into a condition of civil war and simply take over. And so the strategy is an archetypal strategy that continually occurs through the Bible that I've talked about before, and that is the problem of redemption through the primitive. You don't take a charismatic leader from the top or even among equals of the outstanding tribes, because that's too politically dangerous. You go to the very bottom again, and you get redemption from the bottom, redemption through the primitive. And so they choose Saul. But what is it that all that Israel is wanting? It is you and your ancestral house. But I'm a Benjamite, said Saul, from the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family is the least important of all the families of the tribes of Benjamin. And precisely because of that, he is the only one that can bring the Amphictyony together in some form of leadership. Now, the Bible, the English Testament, uses the word king, both in the Oxford Version and the King James Version. But the language in Hebrew is neged, not melech. And melech means king or king of a city-state, and neged means just basically ruler. And so Saul is being anointed by Samuel, but Samuel is trying, in a sense, to hedge his bets by making him a leader and not necessarily a king, and still trying to somehow resist the drift toward centralization, the drift toward empire, the drift by which the autonomy of the tribes is going to be ended and everything is going to be compressed into a monolithic state. And so his hope for that is by picking a man from a tribe that is so low and so insignificant that the power of charismatic prophecy in Samuel will be able to contain that force at the same time that he can contain and put off the civil war of the tribes one against the other. Now, what this course creates is the problem, the second problem of how do you hold values through time, is how do you hold values through time in any particular governing structure or any particular individual? If you choose a prophet, what happens when the prophet dies? If you choose a judge, what happens when the judge dies? If you choose a charismatic war leader or a king, what happens when the king dies? So that the whole problem in 1 and 2 Samuel and into 1 Kings is the problem of charismatic succession. Now, we see in the sense that the Aaronite priesthood has become already decadent because Eli, who is one of the central priests at Shiloh, has sons who are sleeping with the temple prostitutes, and there are temple prostitutes in Israel. And even beyond that kind of sexual abomination of taking on the ways of the Canaanites, the sons of Eli, the chief priest, are taking bribes and are trying to peddle influence and using a form of nepotism and selling of favors. So what you have immediately expressed in the opening of 1 Samuel is the sense of the decay and collapse of the Levitical priesthood, that the charismatic anointing that went from Moses to Aaron and then down from Aaron to the sons of Levi who became the priest has now reached the point where it no longer holds values through time, that the priesthood has decayed. And so what is required is a new investiture of charisma coming not from human institutions, but coming from the wildness of the desert, coming directly from God. So here again we see the same thing that we saw in Genesis, where there was the succession coming through Abraham, And then at right angles to time, there was the Melchizedek priesthood, that which is not in time and that which comes in with its own dispensation, its own charisma, and its own violation of all human institutions. So what you have is continually human culture is always going downhill, and all values are always going in a situation of decadence and decay and loss of value through time. All institutions will turn into their opposites. All institutions will subvert the principles for which they're founded. Therefore, you continually have to intersect with the historical process at strategic moments with a sudden reinvestiture of primitive energy, of wildness, of shamanistic visions, and pick an individual who is not of the priesthood. So when the priesthood begins to decay, then you have the prophetic power coming in through the laity and not through the clergy. This is something that we've seen in the history of the West continually, when the secular clergy of the church would become decadent and concerned with wealth and power. Then the St. Francis of Assisi would try to go out into primitive circumstances, into the culture of poverty, and try to rescue the sacred vision through the regular orders and try and wrest the power away from the papacy and the secular orders. So this battle between the two priesthoods, the battle between priest and prophet, is one that's going back and forth throughout the entire Old Testament and goes on up into the New Testament as well. Now, in a sense, you see the archetypal split beginning with Moses and Aaron. Moses can speak to God face to face, and Aaron is the man who becomes the spokesman for history and institutions, and Aaron becomes the figurehead and fountainhead of the priesthood. But as he becomes an institution, like all institutions, it becomes corrupt, so that finally the sons of Eli show that there's nothing left of it. Now, even when we come to Samuel, who gains his power directly from God, he has a calling, and he hears his name called in the temple, and he finally, at the third time, says, "Here am I, Lord." And then the Lord Yahweh says to him, "I am going to do something great in Israel," and picks Samuel to become the new central force of what Israel is going to be all about. Even with so powerful a figure as Samuel, he too gets caught in the same contradiction, because his own sons fail as judges and begin to take bribes and fall into greed. So if the priesthood succession doesn't work, we see the same thing happening with the prophetic succession, that even the sons of Samuel cannot hold values through time, and that when you go from Samuel to the sons, you have a loss of values through time. So there's a failure of prophetic succession, and this leads, in a sense, to experiments with political succession. How are you going to choose who the new leader is going to be? You, in a sense, have to find the new leader. If you can't create a dynasty where you can pass it on to your sons, then you have to create a process of finding the leader. And this is very much like the succession of an incarnate lama in Tibet, that when the lama of the monastery dies, then the monks have to go forth throughout Tibet or Nepal and find the baby who has become the reincarnation of the dead lama and give him the certain kind of test. So the whole process of not just simply passing on the lamahood to some other monk in the monastery, because obviously that would just create another decadent kind of situation, but of going forth out of the monastery, out of the institutions, into wildness, into the primitive, and there finding the energy you need, is a pattern by which the Tibetans are trying to deal with this basic contradiction. And the Hebrews use the same form of pattern of the mystical way of finding something. So the failure of prophetic succession, in a sense, means you have to go out and find who is going to be the new successor of Samuel, and then who of Saul. What this creates when Saul is found is one of the most fascinating sections in the Old Testament of the really archetypal collision of the prophet and the politician. And here again, we're seeing this pattern, this what I talked about, almost a Wagnerian music drama, where whenever you're seeing one particular conflict, you have to see it as figure against the grounds of the previous conflict, so that if there are these figures moving across the stage of the Bible, there are these larger archetypal forces behind them who are the expressions of what had happened before. So the tension between, say, Pharaoh and Moses that was so archetypal in Exodus now begins to be the tension between the prophet and the politician, the tension between Samuel and Saul. And once again, this is something that's universal. Those of you who have been students in my course last semester will remember the collision in Mexico with Quetzalcoatl, where there was the priestly class and the warriors who had been brought in to protect the religion from the threat of all the neighboring tribes, And slowly the warriors begin to grow in power so that rather than protecting the culture, they begin to be the culture and insist on human sacrifice and push the priesthood class of Quetzalcoatl to the side and come in to rule in terms of the Dark Lord of Tezcatlipoca, the Lord of Human Sacrifice himself. So whether you're dealing with the battle between the warrior and the priest or you're dealing with the battle between the politician and the prophet, you're dealing with basically a collision between power and authority. Now, power and authority is one way of trying to deal with the problem of how to hold values in time. Power believes that you can create human institutions and that these can somehow lock the energy and the charisma into a form that can last and survive. So you create the British Empire, or you create the monarchy, or you create the papacy, and this will enable you to solve all particular problems because you will just raise your standards to such a level that the institution will exclude all evil and it will endure for thousands and thousands of years. The opposite notion is that no human institution really can succeed because of the inherent contradiction of human consciousness, that we tend to do one thing and energize the opposite of what we think. And therefore, the true value in a culture has to come from outside human institutions. And that is a figure who has no power but has authority. Now, the archetypal pattern of this is in the Gilgamesh epic, where Gilgamesh is the great king who has power and builds walls and locks the power into the city, but ultimately he has no power over his mind and falls asleep and can't stay awake and has no power over death and sees his best friend killed. And so he has to go outside the city, outside the institution, and there he finds the figure of authority, the sage Utnapishtim. So with Gilgamesh and Utnapishtim, you have figures of power and authority. With Moses and Pharaoh, you have figures of power and authority. When we're confronting it within the nation of Israel itself, then we have the figure of Samuel as the figure of authority and the visionary, and Saul, the military charismatic leader, the figure of power and violence. But of course, what happens to them is they come to violent collision so that even Samuel can say, how can I go if Saul hears it, he will kill me? Or in one case where Saul actually kills 70 of the priests of the Lord. So we see a situation in which there is a split where Samuel says, all right, I have been a judge and I have combined in myself all power and authority because I am both judge and prophet. But now this tribal form will no longer work against the threat of the Philistines, so we're going to create a division of powers, to use the kind of American phrase, and we will have Saul, who will be our military leader of power, but we'll try to keep him under control, but I will still maintain my role as kind of speaking for the Lord. And they create this kind of delicate balance, but the balance doesn't work. So what's being explored in 1 and 2 Samuel are all the different concepts of leadership, whether it's the Nazir, the man who is consecrated to the Lord so that no razor will ever cut his head and has his power from this kind of wild, shamanistic, yogic quality, like Samson or like Samuel, or the Neged, the kind of charismatic military tribal chieftain leader like Saul, or finally the Melech, the king, David, that succeeds Saul. We're dealing with this particular kind of problem of how to hold values in time and how to experiment with all these different forms of rule. But basically, once again, we're dealing with the problem of failure in human institutions. Now, one of the most interesting sections where this collision between power and authority and culture comes up is where Saul is in a tough strait and he's up pinned against the wall with the Philistines and he's waiting for Samuel to come in and make the sacrifice so that he can succeed in the battle. And Samuel is being tardy and he's put in this horrible situation where leaders are always put in. He's got to make a decision, and so he makes the following decision. The Israelites found themselves in sore straits, for the army was hard pressed. So they hid themselves in caves and holes among the rocks and pits and cisterns. Some of them crossed the Jordan into the district of Gad and Gilead. But Saul remained at Gilgal, and all the people at his back were in alarm. He waited 7 days for his meeting with Samuel, but Samuel did not come to Gilgal. So the people began to drift away from Saul. He said, therefore, bring me the whole offering and the shared offerings. And he offered up the whole offering. So he's taking on the prophetic function of being the initiator of the sacrifice. And he's trying to collapse into his own person and his own role, what had previously been compressed into the role of Samuel as a judge. Saul had just finished the sacrifice when Samuel arrived, and he went out to greet him. Samuel said, what have you done? And Saul answered, I saw that the people were drifting away from me, and you yourself had not come as you had promised, and the Philistines were assembling at Michmash, and I thought, the Philistines will now move against me at Gilgal, and I have not placated the Lord. So I felt compelled to make the whole offering myself. Samuel said to Saul, you have behaved foolishly. You have not kept the command laid on you by the Lord your God. If you had, he would have established your dynasty over Israel for all time. But now your line will not endure. The Lord will seek a man after his own heart and will appoint him prince over his people because you have not kept the Lord's command. So here again you see the central problem. Your dynasty would have succeeded if you had obeyed the rules and not taken on the sacrifice and not become prophet or priest yourself, but maintain your military role, then there would have been a dynastic succession. But now we place the curse upon you, and so now your dynasty will not succeed, and now someone else will have to be found. And so dealing with the kind of amalgamation of power that Saul is attempting, Samuel resists it and blocks it and says there will be no succession. Now it's interesting, when the Philistines wipe out Shiloh and eliminate what had been the main central ceremonial center and sanctuary for the loose confederation of tribes, Samuel's not worried about it at all, because he's not a Levitical priest. He's not from the heritage of Aaron. He does not think that God is somehow simply located in the big temple. He's not concerned with creating a civil religion for a state. But Saul is. Saul wants the Ark of a Covenant placed in some place because he wants to use religion in order to create a politically strong nation state. So here you see one of these peculiar things, that the politician wants to use religion somehow to create a civil religion in which there can be a national temple and a national shrine and a bureaucracy of priests who can work closely with the palace and be kept under control. But the prophets who have their visions out in the desert and chant and scream in ecstasy don't want any part of that. They don't require all those institutional trappings. They know that their power comes from within, and so they depend much more on the anti-institutional, shamanistic, direct access to the Lord. So in this kind of battle, it's very much an attempt for Samuel to maintain the loose federation, to maintain decentralization, and he establishes various kind of hilltop shrines all over Israel. He's not concerned with creating one central one. Where Saul, much more interested in politics, is trying to create a central shrine so that he can create a bureaucracy and go back to the Levitical priesthood. But Samuel knows that the Levitical priesthood is decadent because he grew up under Eli and knew his sons intimately. So we have, in a sense, this whole problem focusing in this collision of opposites, and it comes right down to the aspect that when Saul goes too far, the response is, therefore, one of time. You will not succeed. This will not endure. You have not found the form that can hold values through time. And so there is no dynasty, no succession. Now, the irony is that Saul wants a dynasty, even though he knows he was not chosen by noble birth. And so he was chosen by being found, by basically found by the prophet. This is one of the reasons why he fears David, because David is coming on with charisma. David is being found, and David, too, of the tribe of Jesse, comes from one of the smaller and insignificant tribes, and therefore David is almost another rerun of what Saul had been before. So he's desperately afraid of David. And now the political battle begins to be even more fascinating, because now it begins to be the archetypal struggle of the young David against the older Saul. Once again, this is one of those sections in myth where there's a mythic backdrop behind that, and we have to see the battle of David and Saul against a larger archetypal structure, which is basically one indigenous to all the mythologies of the Near East, both Semitic, Babylonian, Akkadian, and Sumerian. And that is the battle of the older gods with the younger gods. In the Sumerian and Akkadian vision of time, the older gods lose power after a certain time and go into decay, and the younger and more dynamic, powerful gods take over. And so it's a vision of evolution where continually the young are moving into power and the old are being pushed out. So you have this expressed in the Enuma Elish as well as in Sumerian mythology. Now David is presented to us as, again, the primitive. And we're seeing this pattern of we're going to redeem Israel from the bottom through the primitive. And he's presented to us as a shepherd who becomes a king. Well, the archetype of the shepherd king happens to be extremely ancient in the Near East, and it goes all the way back to, again, Sumerian culture of Dumuzi, the shepherd king, who is chosen because Inanna, the goddess from on high, falls in love with the shepherd and raises him up and makes him a king. And so shepherd king begins to be like two opposite terms. You begin to take, say, the wildness of the desert with the structured forms of civilization, and you put them together to have a king who rules from the bottom because of the power of the god. Now what happens with Dumuzi, of course, is he grows in pride and begins to think that he's all-powerful, and so therefore he has to be destroyed in the same way that Saul is destroyed. Now, in the myth of the shepherd king, there is a sense of one attempt to deal with the basic contradiction of human culture. The shepherd is anti-urban and nomadic and is goodness, but survival somehow requires kings and armies and cities and iron and technology. So you can't simply have to have a shepherd. You have to have somehow cities, centralization, power, and technology, and that means kings and kingship. And so you put the two together in an oxymoron, a term that's of two terms that are mutually contradictory, and you get this phenomenon of the shepherd king. So it's a mythic way of trying to deal with the contradictions between civilization and tribe. Now, Dumuzi, the first shepherd king in Samaria, was favored basically by the goddess Inanna because of his sexual attractiveness. And so when the goddess had intercourse with Dumuzi, that created the relationship of the divine order of the sky with the human order of the earth and brought the two of them together in the middle, which was the city, or the ziggurat that rose up. Everything that was low and human is raised up to kingship and reaches the sky. Everything that is celestial descends and touches the earth in the form of the king. And in the sexual intercourse between Dumuzi and Inanna, life is maintained on the earthly plane. So the power of Dumuzi, in a sense, is a very sexual power, his sexual attractiveness. And some of that sexual attractiveness communicates itself through the city and the fertility of the fields. Now, Saul is a warlord, and he's charismatic, and he's taller than the others, and he's a powerful fighter. But David's power is not so much just the fact that he stands taller, but a tremendous personal appeal, personal in a sense, sexual appeal. So part of his power is directly related to his sexuality. And in that sense, that's going back to a pattern that's not only Canaanitic, but it's also Sumerian and is indigenous to the area for thousands of years. Now, part of the sexual power of David is in a sense that it's universal. It's not simply that that women are attracted to him. Saul seems to be homosexually attracted to him, and this kind of rage when the demon comes upon him and throws the spear at David is very much a kind of ambivalent hatred for him. Jonathan loves David more than the love of women, and David himself is said to love Jonathan more than the love of women. And so we see, again, this example of the love of males and that kind of pair bonding that we saw with Gilgamesh and Enkidu. Part of David's power, in a sense, is celebrated by this ecstatic form. Samuel and the early prophets show their power by going into ecstasy and falling on the ground and singing and being swept up in a whole ecstatic power that just comes from no one knows where. And so when the soldiers are sent to get Samuel, they too fall into ecstasy and froth at the mouth and sing and shout. And all of these, again, are intensely Near Eastern patterns. They're not coming from Moses. But when we see David leading the Ark of the Covenant along, what happens is that as he's leading it in Jerusalem, he takes off his clothes and just wears a loincloth and ephod and sings and dances and sings praises to the Lord and does a whole kind of pagan dance while the women of Israel look on. And this whole sense of the half-naked David dancing before the Ark is, of course, almost like a recapitulation of that earlier pattern when they were dancing before the golden calf. You can't imagine Moses stripping down and dancing before the Ark of the Covenant. So there's something wild and powerful and just sheer sexual power in David, and it's part of this universal attractiveness that gives him the kind of charisma that he has. It's a kind of image charisma that, say, JFK had. And of course, JFK was another example of that leader who is sexually attractive and uses his sexual power and energy to affect expressions of it. So what we have, in a sense, is that David is singing and dancing, and his first wife, Michal, looks at him and says, you know, you're carrying on like a slave, and tries to present what would be an urban and sophisticated response to this really primitive, ecstatic, tribal behavior, and says, I mean, that's no way to carry on for the Ark of the Covenant. And it's a peculiar thing that David is trying to bring two things together. The Ark of the Covenant has to go into the shrine to create a centralized bureaucracy and create civilization. But he's trying to also combine the wild, ecstatic ways of the Nabim, the wild, ecstatic prophets, by singing and dancing and using some of the forms that are basically indigenously Canaanitic. When Michal rejects that, he curses her and she is barren through the rest of her life. And so it's clear that she doesn't understand David's sexual power, and therefore she's cut off from it and she is never allowed to give birth. So it's very clearly that anyone who tries to deny his sexual power runs up against the curse and the power that somehow the Lord is favoring him. And even when he has an adulterous relationship with Bathsheba, the Lord takes the first fruits, an incredibly ancient pattern again, and the child of David and Bathsheba dies, but the next children don't, and Bathsheba still remains the favorite wife of David throughout his life. But the interesting aspect is seeing how all these patterns are coming together, the monotheism of Israel, the indigenous Canaanitic ecstatic forms, the older tribal forms of prophecy of Samuel, and the new forms of the emerging civil religion of a civilized nation state. But as they begin to move together, they're forced again to become their opposite, and David dancing before the ark is a recapitulation of the people of Israel in the desert dancing before the golden calf. But here it's being seen positively rather than negatively, and yet the ambiguities are really fraught throughout the whole situation. Now, the power of David, again, is in the sense that he is nothing if not a lover. He begins to, in a sense, carry on like an oriental potentate. And so part of his power is exactly his potency. And this, again, is going back to the indigenous fertility religions of the Sumerians. Yet for all of the myth, as the sexual leader, David is an incredibly sophisticated politician. Now, it's a stroke of genius, in the sense, to try to unite Judah, southern Israel, and Israel, the northern tribes, together by placing the city of David at the center and not having it relate to any of the tribes, but putting in his own mercenary army, putting in a sense, his own Praetorian guard, and putting in a system whereby the capital is right at the border. This is like putting Ottawa right next to French Canada and English Canada. We're putting Washington, D.C. at the interface between North and South. So again, he's trying to deal with the problem of the opposites and the contradiction and the attempt of the culture to tear itself apart and trying to hold the opposites together. But he also cuts across the bureaucracy by setting up his own urban bureaucracy of everyone being responsible to him directly as king. And then the next stroke of genius is to try and silence the tribes by making the city of David not only the national capital, but also the national shrine. And here again we see the attempt on the part of monarchy to always revert to a civil religion and to try to, in a sense, take the power of prophecy and use its charisma, but lock it into your form. And this, of course, is what Samuel is trying to do. He's trying to surround Saul in his structure and make military power part of a content within his larger structure of prophecy. And the politician is trying to use the charisma of the prophet to make it part of the ideological camouflage for political power and just use it for window dressing, but have it basically controlled by moving the prophets out of the desert into the palace, having them on hire by the king himself, and keeping them close at hand so they don't get into trouble by being off in their own particular space in the way that Samuel was. So he silences the tribes by moving in the Ark of the Covenant. This would be as if you took the Vatican and moved it into Washington, D.C. and created a planetary empire. So it's a brilliant stroke of politics. And so the fascination of the man is not only does he seem to be a good soldier, a good lover, but he's also a superb tactician. And so we're seeing, in a sense, a movement toward increasing humanity. We're not dealing with a person who talks face-to-face to God in the way that we did with Abraham. We're not dealing with a man who has his visions in dreams or can interpret dreams as Joseph could. We're not dealing with solely with an ecstatic in the form of Samuel, although David has his ecstatic moments. We're dealing with an artist who basically is trying to express the values of time through song and through particular political acts and formations, and is trying to create out of the Amphictyony and the tribal form a nation and a culture and raise it up to a higher level in both art and war and in political structure. Now, what this creates, of course, is tremendous cultural dislocation, because the tribes are always going into shock as the conservatives are having to deal with this kind of continual modernization process, where the tribes and their power are always being eroded, and everything is moving towards centralization, 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 and everything is trying to block what is in the Hebrew equivalent of states' rights. So what happens is that, of course, in order to really perfect that process of centralization, David really has to create a Vatican. He has to have a national shrine. He has to, therefore, bring in the Ark of the Covenant. He really has to build a temple. And as soon as the king was established in his house, and the Lord had given him security from his enemies on all sides, he said to Nathan the prophet, "Here I live in a house of cedar, while the Ark of God is housed in curtains." Nathan answered the king, "Very well, do whatever you have in mind, for the Lord is with you." But that night the word of the Lord came to Nathan, "Go and say to David, my servant, this is the word of the Lord. Are you the man to build me a house to dwell in? Down to this day I have never dwelt in a house since I brought Israel up from Egypt. I made my journey in a tent and a tabernacle. Whenever I journeyed with Israel, did I ever ask any of the judges whom I appointed shepherds of my people Israel why they had not built me a house of cedar? Then say this to my servant David, this is the word of the Lord of hosts. I took you from the pastures and from following the sheep to be prince over my people Israel. I have been with you wherever you have gone and have destroyed all the enemies in your path. I will make you a great name among the great ones of the earth. I will assign a place for my people Israel. There I will plant them, and they shall dwell in their own land. They shall be disturbed no more. Never again shall wicked men oppress them as they did in the past, ever since the time when I appointed judges over Israel, my people, and I will give you peace from all your enemies. The Lord has told you that he would build up your royal house. When your life ends and you rest with your forefathers, I will set up one of your family and one of your children to succeed you, and I will establish his kingdom. It is he shall build a house in honor of my name, and I will establish his royal throne forever." So the whole sense is, I have always been a dweller in tents. So it's a celebration of the nomad. The tent of the presence is not a national shrine. And so there's a whole kind of traditionalism in which Yahweh is being suspicious of this whole modernization process that's very ambitiously trying to create a nation state and an empire. The necessity to complete the process is, of course, somehow to move in that older power in a new structure and to try to appease the forces of conservative reactionary consciousness and move them into civilization. And so, of course, it's interesting that Yahweh says, does not say no, but definitely says, not for you, but for your children. Because you are imperfect, you are not going to be the chosen vessel to hold these values permanently against the threat of time. Now, interestingly enough, in this problem, even though David is so tremendously charismatic, he too has the same problem of succession. His personal charisma is uninheritable as Samuel's holiness or Saul's fierceness. So once again, the same political dilemma that 1 and 2 Samuel keep hitting themselves up against is, how do you hold on to values through time? How do you create a political structure? How do you pass on anything? And continually coming up with frustration, frustration, and frustration. The frustration of David, of course, is just simply revolt and civil war. Absalom, his own son, revolts against him. And you see, once again, that Mesopotamian pattern of the older gods rejecting and attacking, the younger gods rejecting and attacking the older gods. So out of a short-lived Oriental dynasty, there appears Solomon, and even that succession is not going to be a secure one, because after Solomon, it's torn apart, and the kingdom is divided in half. Now, Solomon is fascinating in a sense, because he represents, in a sense, the peak. But the peak is also the moment of descent. And so all the contradictory nature of consummation are contained in Solomon. It is both a consummation and a finishing. He's the peak of glory, but it's also the kind of ripe moment before rottenness and decline. Now, once again, the period of Solomon is fascinating because it's the period in which the basic canonical structure of the Old Testament as we have it is put together. It's a period of high civilization. There are courtly poets who have reached the level of artistic excellence that they can tell the fascinating story of King David, or they can tell the fascinating story of Joseph in Egypt. It's clear that these court poets are geniuses, and they are brilliant men of arts in the same way that the court poets of the Third Dynasty of Ur were great artists. There's a strange quality to art. Art is always that kind of human expression that comes right at the edge between ripeness and rottenness. There's always a quality in which art is looking back at a whole civilization and summing up as it's about to go out and giving it its kind of elegy. So there's a kind of death knell to artistic excellence. The high achievement of Gilgamesh, a really great work of art, is by a poet in the third dynasty of Ur, and then Ur goes, and Ur is destroyed, and Abraham goes out under the land that God will show him. In the same way that we're dealing with these great artists who are writing and putting together the Old Testament, we have the same sense that Solomon is right at that rotten period when everything is just going to decay. He is himself not yet rotten, but there is that luscious ripeness that is beginning to be soft, beginning to be rotten at the core. So there's a quality to art that you could almost say in the way in which how do you hold values through time in art, that art requires, in a sense, decay. It has to have a kind of fertile soil to feed off it. And so there's an almost inverse relationship between high religious vision in the archaic phase, in which the art is primitive, and fantastically great art in which the religion is decadent. And so when you're getting Michelangelo, you're beginning to get the rottenness of the papacy, and you're beginning to get a kind of Solomonic period where the vision of Christianity is on its way out, and henceforth it'll be carried by the torch, not of the priest, but by the artist. It'll be picked up by the Michelangelos and the Blakes and the Yeats and the Beethovens and people of that sort, and not by a succession of cardinals or popes. So there's a strange kind of phenomenology of art and the phenomenology of opposites in art. Now, when we come to Solomon, we have, in a sense, the contradictions really raised to a pitch, because what they have, in a sense, is the moment of triumph, but it's almost the moment of triumph in a very nouveau riche way, that finally, in a sense, they were slaves under Pharaoh, and now they've made it. And so when you come to 1 Kings, you have page after page after page of a catalog of the descriptions of the temple. And there was gold here, and there was gold there, and the cherubim were 5 feet wide on this side, and 5 feet wide on this side, and so-and-so was cubits high, and there was this amount of bronze, and this amount of bronze, and this kind of curtain, and the rest of it. It goes on and on and on, so that if you really picture the descriptions of the temple of the Lord, it looks like the Miami Fontainebleau Hotel or the dunes in Las Vegas. This is clearly the culture of the nouveau riche. They finally got it, and now they've got their own money, and they're going to spend like crazy, and they begin to become pharaohs themselves. So you get the strange kind of phenomenon that the covenant is just cashed into a nation state, that the Hebrews escape Egypt, but what happens? They cash in the covenant of the Lord for a lousy state in the kind of armpit of three continents and try just to turn it into a kind of acquisitive, grasping, materialistic culture in which everything begins to be described in greater and greater amounts of schlock and just vulgar consumerism. Now, God himself is appalled at this, and he wonders about moving into a structure that's designed by Canaanites, built by Phoenician craftsmen, worshipped in a sense by Neo-Canaanites, and he said, I will get into your temple on the condition that you promise to sign a new covenant with me to always observe my laws and not fall into the pagan ways. And of course, they all say, of course, of course, of course, you know, sure, we promise always to be good Hebrews and not to become pagans again. And so he says, all right, but with great trepidation, this whole sense, you know, again, Yahweh is saying, I have always dwelled within a tent. Why do I have to move into this temple? But of course, Solomon has ambitions, because part of the nature of priestcraft is to specialize in God management. And so you think more or less that you can manage God, and if he'll just behave himself and move into the temple and follow the kind of appropriate ceremonies, then everything will be well in Israel. And in an ingenious way, with some of the political savvy of his father, Solomon begins to really understand the political use of the temple. Because as he goes to say his prayer of dedication, he's basically saying, whenever Israel is oppressed, whenever there are not rain clouds in the sky, whenever there is hardship, may each of us look toward this temple, and God, may you in your infinite power hear us here. And so he's making sort of lip service that, yes, the God of hosts cannot be locked into a temple, that he dwells in infinity, but he's basically saying, let this place be special. But he's also saying to the tribes, whenever you're in trouble, look toward this temple. And so he's creating an intermediary. Henceforth, let's not have any just savages throwing out their rugs in the sand and praying, because that's the last thing you want. You want to control the divine. You want to get all those primitive nomads locked into an urban structure, get them paying their taxes and making them obedient, and having their wealth accumulate to support what is, in a sense, a nation state. So what Solomon wants is a civil religion. He does not want simply the Mosaic covenant or the covenant of Joshua. So what happens is we get basically an Oriental potentate and the whole sense that the Anantodromia begins to be complete, because Moses tried to take on Pharaoh and take the Hebrews away from civilization and its discontents, and the fullest development of that process is that Solomon becomes the new Pharaoh and the Hebrews themselves have become the Egyptians, and the whole attempt to create a new vision of values and time utterly fails, and that the people who were the most brilliant critics of civilization have now become trapped in civilization and all its discontents. By the end of his life, Solomon, for all his promises, is lighting candles to Ishtar. King Solomon was a lover of women, and besides Pharaoh's daughter, he married many foreign women. So notice, in a sense, the marriage back to Pharaoh. Moses is trying to get away from Pharaoh. What's Solomon doing? He's marrying into the family again. So the whole thing is being undercut. But besides, he married many foreign women, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite, from the nations with whom the Lord had forbidden the Israelites to intermarry, because, he said, they will entice you to serve their gods. But Solomon was devoted to them and loved them dearly. He had 700 wives who were princesses and 300 concubines, and they turned his heart from the truth. When he grew old, his wives turned his heart to follow other gods, and he did not remain wholly to loyal to the Lord his God as his father David had been. He followed Ashtoreth, goddess of the Sidonians, and Milcom, the loathsome god of the Ammonites. And so finally Solomon himself is a pagan and becomes the Pharaoh, and the whole experiment, in a sense, is proven a failure. You can't have a Hebrew content in a Canaanitic structure. The structure was built by specialists and technologists and metal craftsmen. It was done by Phoenician architects, and therefore, with that kind of Phoenician structure, of course it's going to be a Phoenician religion that takes place inside it. Once you move out of the tent and into the temple, you've abandoned the pastoral vision, and you've moved into civilization. So what it does is to create the paradox that the Hebrews lose by success. Therefore, they can only be reaffirmed in the values of the Lord through failure. Henceforth, the Hebrews will have to become the people who fail. They will have to become weak because in their strength they failed the whole prophetic vision. So you get this whole paradox again that success, worldly success, is a failure in eternity, and failure in the world is a success with the Lord. And so again, the opposites are brought together in a new kind of contradiction. So what kind of culture can hold values against the flow of time? Definitely not a successful civilization. If you are an empire, you are obviously depraved. There is no way that power can be held under the aspect of eternity. So what you have, in a sense, is the Anantodromia, which is a process by which a phenomenon, when it's completed, at its end, has become its exact opposite. So you start with Moses rejecting Pharaoh, and you play it out for a few centuries until you get the Hebrew Pharaoh with Solomon and Israel becoming another Egypt. Now, Abraham left Ur, and Genesis cursed the cities. Moses left Egypt and cursed Pharaoh. Now the children of Egypt, in a sense, have parlayed the promised land into an empire. Solomon fails, David fails, Saul fails, all for different reasons. And the analysis of failure in these chapters is really the most fascinating thing about it. Why does dynastic succession fail? Why does the Levitical priesthood fail? Why does David fail? Why does Saul fail? Why, indeed, does Solomon fail? So what happens, in a sense, is that ultimately, one is dealt with an irreconcilable contradiction. The Genesis mapped the nature of contradictions and the nature of human consciousness, and what the rest of the Old Testament is doing is fleshing out the intensity of the agony of the war of opposites inside the human breast. So what politics are possible? We like to define politics as the art of the possible, but when seen from another perspective, what politics are possible of all? How can values be held inside history? Now, what happens, in a sense, is that if values cannot be held inside history, then consciousness has to be deflected to look at the historical process itself. The whole war of the opposites, the way in which Moses and Pharaoh fight, the way in which Samuel and Saul fight, the way in which David and Absalom fight. And once one sees the battle of, say, the Nabi, the prophet, and the Nagi, the leader, in another kind of agon by which the larger historical truth is not contained in either one or the other, but in another force overriding both, and that truth is being played out not inside history, but through and with the historical process itself, then you have a kind of dislocation of consciousness or a displacement of consciousness from the center to another kind of contemplative space where the nature of values and ideology and conflict undergoes a whole kind of transformation. So what you see, in a sense, with 1 and 2 Samuel is that centralization is wrong. It's obviously evil. There's a marvelous section, let me see if I can find it, in Chronicles, where Satan tempts David to have a survey of the people and tries to number them quantitatively. And David repents of it because he knows it's evil. I can't find the exact page. I may have to find it at the... here it is. I got it. Good. Now Satan, setting himself against Israel, incited David to count the people. This is civilization, quantity, measurement, your social security card, the computer invasion of privacy, the whole thing. And the tribes don't like it because they know it's against their whole aspect of states' rights, decentralization, the tribal ways. God was displeased with all of this and proceeded to punish Israel. David said to God, I have done a very wicked thing. I pray thee, remove thy servant's guilt, for I have been very foolish. And he knows that somehow or other he's gone too far in this direction of civilization by actually trying to count the people as if somehow or other blood could be measured and quantified. So obviously centralization is evil, but on the other hand, it's very clear that decentralization is evil also, and that the continual blood fighting of the tribes one against the other is just laying them open to the Philistines and they're being wiped off the face of the earth. So you can't simply say that decentralization is good and Samuel is right, because it's both right and wrong, and you can't say that centralization is evil, because there's also a way in which it's an absolute political necessity of the time. So in the collision of the opposites of centralization and decentralization, you come against a political model in which the truth is overlighting both simultaneously, and there is no way that you can affirm one ideology or the other. And it seems to me that's as eternally true for the relationship of the nation state and the planet now as it was then. So what you have, in a sense, going on in the Old Testament is moving from historical narrative where you stand inside it and identify with the characters to moving into it and seeing it in the terms of the almost lectio divina of a reading where it becomes an object of contemplation, and the historical process itself begins to be a model for another kind of dimension of reality. And when that happens, you move from the center of history, to where all the battles are occurring, to the side, where continually the intersection into history at right angles to time is occurring from the kind of investiture, shamanistically or prophetically, outside institutions. So you have first Melchizedek coming in and touching in the historical moment of Abraham, and then you have Moses coming in, generating the opposite with Aaron and the Levitical priesthood. Now you're beginning to move toward the situation where the next figures we'll see next week will be the mysteries of Elijah and the role of prophecy and the disruption of politics and the investiture of charisma, again, at right angles to institutional time, bringing back to, again, the mysteries of the order of Melchizedek and the whole esoteric dimension that now history begins to be not so much a simple drama, but a very complex phenomenology of opposites where both prophet and priest and prophet and king are simultaneously right and simultaneously wrong. Thanks. Let's take a break and come back. Who wants to start it off in terms of disagreements or arguments or questions or comments or additions or supplements? Kevin.
Kind of a ridiculous question, but when you're looking at all these things and becoming conscious of history, is there any possible way of not repeating history? Not repeating the patterns and the opposites confronting each other? I guess you can't, but...
Yeah. Well, I think the nature of history, like an art or like a musical theme and variation, is that an archetype is like a structure of parameters of restraint but not control, that it creates conditions in which a game can occur, because if it was unconditioned, there could be no game. You've got to have a net to play tennis. And so it's like if you're an artist and you find yourself surrounded by a concerto and it's your time to play a cadenza, there's so much freedom you have and so much freedom you don't have. So you have to still play within what's given you, but there's tremendous freedom for kind of, you know, innovation and theme and variation and a display of your own excellence. So that when the patterns repeat, the confrontation of, say, Moses and Pharaoh is not the same as the confrontation between Samuel and Saul, and yet there are echoes that one can hear musically going on between these things. So that the novelty is, in a sense, that history is always open-ended, free, undetermined, and yet at the same time there is an element of in which it's conditioned. So history always repeats structures, but never in the same way. So it's an oxymoron itself.
Is it a process of evolving to something, or is it just when it gets played out in another stage? Is it just another nightmare that you have to escape?
I think that's a good question. Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. I think there are two responses to that. One is to say that to the degree that you become conscious of history, you're no longer in the conditioned, and you then become. As what Michael was saying last night about the description of enlightenment being unconditioned, that the stage of enlightenment is the unconditioned state. To the degree that you're ignorant of history, you're doomed to repeat it, as Saniyana said. So that if you're caught in a historical predicament, then you're going to play out all the contradictions and not even realize it. As you begin to be more conscious of the patterns, you then begin to become free of them. So, you know, you were quoting Joyce, if history is the nightmare from which I'm trying to awaken. Now, the way Jesus deals with these patterns is really fascinating. He tries, in a sense, to consummate the patterns as a way of finishing them. He doesn't escape them. He always is saying, we must follow the word of the prophets, word by word and letter by letter. I must ride on an ass into Jerusalem because the prophecies require that. So he's trying to, in a sense, consummate all the patterns of history to, in a sense, finish them in the figure of being the anointed one, of being the Christos. So that one way to finish something is to so bring it to form that you step out of it. You know, it's like the same sense of an artist, like Milton, when he writes the vision of Paradise Lost, it enables you, in a sense, to step out of the Christian vision of history, because now you're reading it as an artifact. And so that's, again, that quality of edge. You bring something to a form, and then the form enables you to step beyond it. So if we begin to be conscious of history now, I think it does mean that history, in a sense, is ending. And if we begin to be conscious of the contradictions of human culture, it means that human culture as we know it is ending, and that we are in what Aurobindo calls another state of consciousness in which history is being transcended. But the way to transcend it in good Hegelian fashion is to go back and lift it up, affirm it, negate it, and move beyond it, you know, the literal dialectic of Aufheben. So it's again, different people play with history in different ways. There's Jesus' way, and there's Milton's way. Yeah. Yeah, it does. For the people who come after you. Your enlightenment becomes other person's information. I mean that in a negative sense, that it's just, you can't pass on enlightenment. Yeah. Tom?
Over and over, you seem to have either said or implied that perversity is a concomitant of creation. Whitehead says this, too. It's impossible that one without the other. But in a way, the whole story you told is the triumph of perversity. David and Jonathan, you touched on very little.
Yeah.
And yet it's a huge mythological experience for thousands and thousands of people. What does it mean? I mean, it seems to me that David and Jonathan, what you get when you read Samuel 1 and 2 is a sort of sanction of... in between the lines, sanction of perversity as a concomitant of creativity, not as a concomitant of pleasure.
Well, that's more complicated. If we're saying, I'm not too sure that male bonding, pair bonding, is the same thing as homosexuality. If you're designing...
No, that's the last thing I'm interested in.
Okay.
At all.
All right. Then what direction are you going in?
That a thing has to be bent. Seemingly, the human position being always between two things, which are always changing, then there's only one way to keep your sanity, which is to interject a note of perversity into your position.
Perversity is...
Art is impossible.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's true. Well, that's why I was trying to say, in a sense, that there's something really rotten about art. That in a good culture, you wouldn't need art. Art is a condition of the fall.
Oh, that's dangerous.
It's blasphemy in the
art. Oh, blasphemy.
Yes, yes.
Well, you throw out all the expressions. The first two Picasso, the first abstract expression.
But if we say that perversity is an exercise of one's freedom to twist something, if basically God gives humanity freedom and says, in giving you freedom, I'm giving you the ability to twist the message or to twist the culture or to twist to become perverse, then some people can only really test their freedom by destruction or turning or twisting to really know that, in a sense, that they really are, in a sense, free. And so that kind of satanic impulse of, I will not serve, I will take the message of obedience and twist it. If you become God, I will become your opposite as Satan, is in a sense testing the limits of the manifest universe. If it's created, what is the play in creation? You know, literally in the sense of the several meanings of that word. And so you play with God and you test the limits and you play on the line and you sometimes, and Chardin talks about this too, you sometimes of necessity fall into evil because evil is the concomitant of freedom.
To protect yourself.
Yeah. Well, sanity is, I think, a smaller level of consciousness. I don't think that... I think these other categories I'm talking would be at another higher level of order, and that sanity is simply one response to try and hold values through time, and it's not necessarily always the best one.
Did you have a perversity in Abraham, too, as well as in Moses,
but
Abraham?
But sometimes the perversity is from the point of view of the Levitical priesthood that's trying to define a canonical moral order, and saying it is immoral to have more than one wife. And so we go to the Bible and we see these guys have got dozens, you know. Or it is immoral to do this or to do that, and then we see them continually doing it. So when we're confronted with the actuality of Samuel hacking up the Amalekite. Yeah. The who?
Or Christ in the temple.
Yeah, right. There's always a way in which the pariah figure, the prophet, affirms morality by... affirms the sacred by destroying the moral canon, because the moral canon has become a lock or an imprisonment.
Almost the only way.
And in that sense, you can say that they're being perverse, in the way that Jesus is perverse, or, you know, controversial figures like Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche are perverse in affirmation of some other kind of higher moral vision. So that's the collision between the Levitical priesthood that's always trying to say, thou shalt not, and trying to figure it all out and count and quantify it, and the prophetic vision that's much more of the heart and much more shamanistic. So if you mean by perversity in that, yeah, there's a torque, and a torque has energy, you know, and when history spins, it's because it twists and turns, you know.
But it's more than that. It's almost the only way out. In the midst of forces that are impossible and beyond anyone's control, you have to go beat up the money changers in the temple. Or do something, you know, that's not generally considered the right thing to do.
Well, there are two ways.
And that's perversity.
No, I think perversity basically has to do with growth.
Well,
rather, you so look at it that way. Rather than as it is.
Well, art's impossible, but art's getting short shrift here.
Right.
All artists are going to get put out.
Right.
They're ruined and wasted.
Right.
And they're a perverse bunch of sod. They can't be cut straight.
Right.
Idolaters,
idolaters at the temple. Well, there are several ways. You know, the Western way is to revel in perversity and be the kind of self-dramatic existential hero, you know, grimacing in the mirror to scare yourself and sense I'm really powerful. The Oriental way is, you know, just to go toward the center and move out of the historical thing. You know, if you feel a wave coming on you, you can dive through it and not have it throw you on the sand. Or you can try to gracefully ride it in somehow in the consummate artistic display. Or you can make a great big splash of your own muscular energy and get thrown into the sand and, you know, dished out. You can, in your historical circumstance, you can try to historically take on and affirm the only way that I can be free and sane is by perversity. And therefore, whenever I see a straight line, I will twist it, which is basically the artist. I hate morality and sanctity and piety, and therefore I will make statues out of shit, or I will, whatever the bourgeoisie like, I will try to shock them, épater les bourgeois, you know. And that begins to be a new canon of reveling in conscious perversity, but that's really histrionic from an Oriental point of view. I mean, it's just, you know,
it's
compare...
not histrionic from an Oriental point of view.
Sorry? I didn't hear
not
that.
Not histrionic from an Oriental point of view.
Right. No, that depends where you're standing. So, or sitting in the case of Zen. We tend, because we're in history, to try and find a way to ride the wave in, and the price we pay for that is all the histrionics of getting tossed about in the wave and not being able to really gracefully understand our moment in time. And to the degree that we begin to gracefully ride the wave, then there's always the arrogance that can set in which you finally get dished. So that but I think still basically the Western attempt is to try and realize the sacred through the flow of time, and the Oriental is to move to the side, to go toward the center, and realize that history is just merely illusion or Maya. Now, in a sense, I'm saying something similar to that at the end when I'm saying if you're inside history and identifying with it, then you're good guys against bad guys. If you move to a contemplative space where you see the simultaneity of both Samuel and Saul, of being both right, then history is beginning to become an object for meditation or contemplation, and the historical process itself is beginning to be raised up to a level of consciousness. Then you begin to peer behind the set, and you see that there are those two-by-fours holding up the set of history, and that it's somewhat illusory. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't decide to go walk back down the movie set to have a display of your excellence and accept your moment in time, because that's what an artist like Faulkner does. He says, knowing better, and say, go down Moses, I still affirm my time, I'm a southern white man, I'm going to be in this moment of time knowing better, knowing that this is a limited moment. And so he affirms his condition, and if you affirm your condition with enough love and compassion, then the condition releases itself and can give you an experience of the unconditioned, and that's that paradox of enlightenment.
Well, this is what David did to Saul, isn't it, with the endless letting him go. Hmm. You let him go time after time after
but always, time. Always with style and grace, of cutting off the corner of his robe and saying, no, why?
You can say, look, I let him go all these times, so now I can feel like he's wiping out him off.
Well, he allowed the historical process to wipe him out, which is, yeah. Well, it wasn't all in his control. Any other... All of them? I mean, lots of different people.
The stuff we've been talking about.
Well, the usual scholarly...
By somebody who knows what you're saying.
No, you can have a dream and not be conscious of its meaning.
Yeah, of course you can. Yeah, that's what I'm asking.
Yeah.
What order of consciousness went into the writing of the book?
I think when there's a stock of archetypal images and metaphors in the culture and in the unconscious, it gives you space with which to create so that you don't have to understand what you're creating. And therefore, things emerge out of the impersonal collective consciousness that may not be rationally constructed. So that a person may think he's writing an apology for David and trying to make David look good and Saul look bad. And out of it may develop a much more interesting relationship between the characters of Saul and David than might have been the conscious. In other words, I think an artist can have conscious purpose, but that the aspect of being an artist is that that conscious purpose is not the full consciousness, and that all the other marginal areas of consciousness are coming forth in the communication. And whereas in a scientific description, you would eliminate, presumably, ambiguity, you would eliminate archetypal images, and you would just try to present data, like chronicles. I mean, you read chronicles and you're like, God, you know. Whereas it's not the same when you read the same story over again in Samuel. Yeah, Leon.
There was an interesting footnote to the question Gregory asked, and that is, according to my very short homework, you have two sources in Samuel 1 and 2, which was originally one narrative sequence, and they're called the old one and the younger one. The old one was written, presumably, according to scholarship, during Samuel's time by a single author. And the second one was rather compiled during late Divided Kingdom times, right towards the end of the Divided Kingdoms in the 4th, 5th century B.C. The old version is predominantly, they're mixed, but the old version is predominantly in Samuel 2. The new version is predominantly in Samuel 1. Now, presumably, these two versions were mixed and compiled by the priests of Babylonian captivity. The new version, the Samuel 1, is the old version, which does not affirm kingship. The early version, which sees Samuel as a very low figure and Solomon as being the anointed king of God and the leader and ruler and the warrior and so forth, giving over to David, is in 2 Samuel. Now, if they were conscious of the history of foresight and hindsight and writing after the Babylonian captivity and recognizing these patterns, then they would have structured it just the opposite than the way they did. That is to say, the foresight would have seen it's a good idea to have king, this king is a man of God, and so forth. Then it happens, and see what happens, it's not such a good idea after all. The structure is just back from what you would expect of men contemplating history.
But that happens a lot in terms of when you get all these different multiple authors of where the Yahwist or the Elohist and the priestly redactor, that sometimes they don't have, because this material is sacred, they don't have the nerve to just throw it out. And so they'll sometimes just lob it in there, and so it'll stick out like a fossil. And they somehow or other are able to tolerate the contradiction. And because they are, you have a much richer story in which you get things that are much fuller than if it had been only the priestly redactor who just eliminated everything he didn't understand.
Including how they got their stories, how the seven stones got in the River Jordan.
Right, right.
When you give a lecture, what I get is an outline for literally a multi-level systems theory of history, right? In which these anandromia are stacked up in increasingly more comprehensive systems, so that you can literally at the bottom at some call it bottom, okay? At the bottom you may have technological levels, at the top you may have political levels or historical levels, contemplative levels, however you want to organize it. Each one affecting the other, each one having its own feedback systems and variables pertinent to it, okay? Supposing you could in fact structure such a system so you in fact would have a technology of history, then history would be the technology of history.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that the Levitical impulse, though, in the sense of trying to have God management or historical management? I mean, it seems to me that the difference is, this is the difference that makes a difference. I'm seeing history not so much as systems, but seeing it or hearing it more like a Wagnerian music drama, where these things are echoes and motifs that pick up, but never in the same way. And so there's always this kind of turning the thing in the light so it catches a different kind of light, and that these patterns are recapitulating and playing, but it's all play rather than system, because basically each one is affirming its freedom from the form. Now in a system, it seems to me that the congruence and the similarity has to be such that you can't have too much digression or diversion, otherwise it's no longer a system. It begins to be something else.
You can have so complex a system that you never get the same motif twice running. That is to say, if you have 52 variables and each one of them has a range from 1 to 1,000, you can get combinations of all of those variables that will never repeat. Mm-hmm. But the system is still constrained by the number of variables and the number of values in the system and the feedback loops. You see.
Like the I Ching having so many hexagons.
Yeah, so that in the same way that you can't play, that there's not infinite amount of variation in a piece of music, so there's not infinite variation of system. But in a very large system, you have a very finitely very large range of interplay that's possible.
I just don't think the system can be abstracted from the drama, and I suppose my models therefore have to be narrative or mythopoeic, because I would identify as the Levitical or the satanic impulse, the attempt to turn it from history into system, or to create, you know, say if I were like Skinner and say, aha, I now understand history, therefore I can go into historical management and manage history and try to create cultural conditions in which history will perform according to my system. This is like Asimov's foundation, in a sense, the professor who understood history and sets up the foundation. And I basically don't think that's possible.
You think it's not possible?
Yeah, I don't think it's possible.
Well,
might do it, but they'd be fools. It wouldn't.
Yeah, because I think of the basic enantiodromia thing, that I would suspect that the system would become its own cage. It's like
little fleas upon their back have smaller fleas that bite them.
Yeah, and little fleas have smaller fleas that bite them.
Yeah.
And so there is this aspect in which it's a basic category mistake to try to respond to the ocean by trying to structure it or manage it or create topology of wave function so that you can become a better swimmer. Seems to me the mistake of conscious purpose, and that the more graceful way is the artistic way, the way of the unconscious, and the way of spontaneity and response and freedom, so that you swim in the ocean, you don't drink it, and you don't manage it. And that I don't think the things that I'm describing move in the direction of a systems model. And I think if it were abstracted out of its context into a system, then I would agree with Frost when he says that poetry is that which is lost in translation, that everything that I'm saying would be lost in the translation into systems theory and systems management. And so that unidentifiable thing seems to me continually what the prophets understand, but the Levitical priesthood cannot. And they continually say, well, now how can we, yes, I understand someone, but now how can we freeze it? And how can we really lock it into form so that we can use it? And continually we see the failure of that impulse. So for me, would be the reason why the systems theory can't succeed, and why in Evil and World Order I was trying to take the opposite approach. In a sense, what I'm doing is fairly analogous to what Thomas Mann does in Joseph and His Brothers, the way he treats the myth and archetype and pattern and repeating things and uses it into narrative. Using systems. Well, your language was loaded in the sense of using systems and technology.
Okay.
Those are bad words.
So I think I did that perhaps for perverse reasons.
Yes, I think so too.
And so let's.
You're on your way.
Let's backtrack and say let's undo the systems part and simply say, if we can become in whatever form conscious of the interplay of patterns in history, then history becomes the consciousness of the interplay of patterns in history.
But it also,
and that makes a very different kind of history.
Yeah, that's right. I agree. Yeah, if the history of nature includes the consciousness of the laws of nature, then the history of nature changes, because there are people inside the history of nature who understand the second law and things of this sort, and they begin to have feedback upon the planet, so the planet now changes and other kinds of information are in the biosphere, like pollution. So that it's very clear that the consciousness of history changes history. And there is, to use that systems metaphor, a feedback loop. But the way in which it seems to me to play itself out is that being aware of certain patterns is like being aware of certain steps in a dance. But there's still always this aspect of freedom and spontaneity, and the nature of your true insight is to not to try and turn it into a machine, but to always allow the unexplained and the irrational to always come in, so that the fascination, in a sense, with Jesus as a figure moving through historical time, knowing that he's headed toward Golgotha, and playing on these patterns consciously. He consummates the historical pattern, which means, in a sense, that he is, for all intents and purposes, ending Old Testament history, which, of course, is the esoteric Christian vision, that this is a consummation. Henceforth, history is dramatically changed, and now the nature of human consciousness on the planet is radically enhanced. And I would say, in a sense, the same thing is going on now, that we're really playing around with human culture quite consciously, because we've got anthropology and we've got all these other cultural history, and that, I think, rather than creating a system, has now enhanced the undetermined and enhanced our freedom, because now we're really open up to a lot of unexpected things happening, because we're busting out of the old game, and that begins to be much more exciting and much more mysterious and exciting and more playful than if a historian thought, oh boy, I understand everything about history, and it's all wrapped up. And then, yeah.
I'm just interested in a little bit about what you said about Christ. I'm just curious what Yahweh means to you in Greekness. I'm not trying to put you together. I don't want you to say you define God. I'm just wondering, as you were going through this play.
When I'm quoting the words that are Yahweh's, yeah. Yahweh is I would say Yahweh is a thought form of a race. And it's image of divinity in historical time. But in a Buddhist context, I would still say that this is a thought form. And that Godhead is at a higher level than Yahweh.
Yeah. Also, thinking whether the fact that in this sense Yahweh is a single figure, right? And you've moved away from this pantheistic. I mean, God. So at this point in this play, we've rejected this one figure, and I don't know at this time since we've come going back to the opposite again of somehow spreading it around.
Polytheism, yeah. This is, I think, also because there were monotheists in ancient culture, that the usual historical narrative that the Hebrews invented monotheism I don't think is true, and that it's a misunderstanding of polytheism. And now that we've been playing out that monotheistic myth for so long, the Christian theologians are getting very excited about being polytheists again. So people like David Miller in the religion department at the University of Syracuse talks about being a polytheist and affirming the way divinity plays itself out in multiple roles and forms, so that it's sometimes we falsify reality by our simple historical narratives. But in the case that I'm dealing with here, it's the way divinity comes down in the historical time. And therefore, in a sense, it's conditioned. And Yahweh, for me, would not be unconditioned Godhead. It may emanate from that, but that's up at a higher level. Tom.
What is the difference? How did it, in this time that we're looking at, how do they look at time and history, as opposed to, say, the way that we're looking at it, we're discussing their time? How do they have a historical sense, like the Greeks did, or what was their historical sense?
I think what the book is about is, in a sense, the attempt for the prophets to create a historical consciousness, and the continual way in which the tribes break away with a much more immediate, short-term view of things. I mean, this is just human nature. I mean, when the people in the Bronx go out to loot, they're slitting their own throats in terms of what's going to happen, you know, when they're ripping off the mom-and-pop store. But they're thinking, basically, I want to get some of mine now. And so you always have the difference between the person who's looking at the whole view and trying to balance it out, and the individual saying, I can't handle that, I just want mine now. And, you know, this is pretty much the same battle that Samuel has against the tribes, or David, any of them.